So my two non-negotiable values are loyalty and self-expression. And what does that mean? That means that, I can get in trouble. Because here's the thing with your non-negotiable values. If you see them being acted upon, if you see them fulfilled, your heart sings. That's like the best joy ever. If you see them being violated, you become angry. You become enraged. Angry doesn't quite cut it, right? Now, we all know how to avoid jail time, right? And so we have become quite good at handling our rage when it comes up, but the rage itself will come up. And that is, again, non-negotiable. You see something that's so wrong, you're getting worked up, right? These are toned down words to say you want to kill somebody. And so these are my two, and I've been personally in trouble with situations where I see, for example, leadership being disloyal to the group, to the point that I got, kicked out of organizations, or I was in the morning. The funny story was that in the morning I was invited to join a leadership board of a large organization, and then something happened which I had to intervene. So I raised my hand and I told everybody what my opinion was, and that was, from their perspective, uncalled for enough to kick me out of that leadership board. Team afterwards, all in the same day, right? And then the question becomes, what happens when you're in a messy situation, right? So I have a story that, in fact, I wrote and published that story as a part of a compilation. I was challenged by one of my business coaches to hit a target within 3 months, and I had a hard time. It was a large target. It was a sales target, and I had a really hard time, and I kept going, and I kind of got closer, not closer. And then I made a deal with, now you can fill in your own blank about my deal. Right, you can say I made that deal with myself. You can say I made that deal with God. I said I made that deal with life, but I said, okay, if I hit that, then I'm gonna spend 10% of the money on charity. Right now, contextually, the most we've spent on charity up to that point in time was $360. That was the history of that, right? And nothing happened, nothing happened, nothing happened. Deadline occurred. And in the morning of that deadline, I'm getting an email saying, okay, I'm going for it. I'm buying your deal. In fact, what I said was the deal was the last. I need to clarify that the last sale that I make in order to get over that target, that sale goes to charity. And that morning I made a $10,000 sale. So now I had a conflict, right? To make things a little bit more complicated, that whole thing with that promise that I made, that the last deal that I make that gets me there goes to charity, I kind of neglected to share that with my wife. And that complicates things,
Yes.
right? So, now here's the situation. Now, what am I loyal to? Am I loyal to my word, / God? Am I loyal to my family and my wife? Am I what am I loyal to?
Yeah.
Right? That money was not just substantial, it was needed at that point in time. And so I knew I was in trouble, right? And I knew that the only way out of trouble really is to have a conversation with everybody and find a way to express loyalty to everybody.
Yeah.
And a conversation would already be a step towards expressing loyalty, but I didn't feel that was quite enough. And I was lucky enough to be able to reach an agreement that allowed me to keep my word, keep my marriage, keep everything. But at the end of the day, if I was not trained enough or practice enough and or knowledgeable or experienced or whatever you want to use enough to understand that unless I'm going to find a way to fulfill loyalty to all involved parties, I'm going to be miserable. I'm going to probably sabotage something somewhere unconsciously because of that.
Yeah.
And I knew that. So I had to, you know, donation was made. and I found a way to make sure everybody is happy and on board and fulfilled. And it was a great story and a great feeling to come out on this other side, because it's like when you feel a threat to your value and you're able to fulfill it, then of course that's a success.
Yeah. Absolutely.
And I'm guessing that you the problem made the contribution and the donation anyway, you know, when you and whether you'd met the target or not. So that would become secondary in the situation. But at the same time, you were having to balance in many parts of what you call your areas of life. And I was going to ask you around that as well, is that as you listed them off in the presentation, career, finance, relationships, environment, health, and spiritual, and I know that you said that they were all on equal footing, but I was just wondering whether there was an order, whether there was a priority there, and that helped in your decision-making. So were you
the
making it primarily because of...
if they're on equal footing, then there's no priority. But there is.
Well,
one.
Yes, I mean, I was trying to interpret it as if it's an equal footing, there's an equal weighting, shall we say, on each of those values.
No.
So the priority is irrelevant. The weighting is all the same. Okay, understood.
No. let me clarify a little bit. There is. The equal footing is I'm missing a word, right? In principle, there is equal footing for every area of life. Situationally, there is not. Situationally, there is an area that has the biggest problem right now. So my practice, which is called life design, my practice starts with an evaluation of all six, and it takes exactly, I'd be generous if I gave you 60 seconds.
Okay.
Because we list them and we go off the top of your head, the first thing that goes through your mind on a scale from 1 to 10, are you doing on finances? Right now, between the time that I say finances and the time that I followed up with the word right, you both have a number. You do. You answered the question. I didn't even ask, right? So we make that evaluation, right? And of course, you can have two with equal rank and all of that, but the one that's least performing is the one you need to pay your attention to right now, right? Yeah. So if you're in financial trouble, yeah, go fix your financial trouble and then fix your health.
Yeah.
Right? If your health is what's suffering right now, you better regain your health, or otherwise you'll be in no position to make money.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Yeah. Or function in your relationship or whatever it is, right? Some of the tricky parts are actually perceiving the things like spiritual or environment as having equal footing as relationship or health, right? Because when you look at finance, relationship, and health, then these are like the three that are prevalent in people's mind, right? So yeah. they want to make money, they want to be healthy, they want to have a good relationship. Great. Yeah. But if you're a hoarder and you live in a house full of junk, then the rest of your life are going to go down with it.
Mm.
So situationally, you always treat the one that needs help. And part of it is you do that evaluation on a quarterly basis, on a semi-annual basis. In other words, frequently enough, so that you don't find yourself, okay, you had a problem, you fixed it, and now you're not asking the question, what is the highest priority right now, until, you know, or never. Does that answer the question?
I believe so, yeah. I mean, and I think that's what I was looking to articulate, was that situational response, if you like, to then test your values in those areas and see what one gets tested. And I guess a follow-up question would be, if you didn't have financial problems, you weren't having relationship problems, you weren't having career problems, etc., would you on occasion go and test yourself by creating a situation that puts anyone in these under stress enough to kind of, so that you don't forget them? Or do you feel that on a daily basis or at least a periodical basis, these will be tested?
I think that's individual, but there are two general approaches to that. And in psychology, there's a distinction between people who are maximizers and people who are good enough first, right? And so when you tell me there are six areas of life and each and every one of them you ranked as 10, that's a point in time where either you believe in good enough and you just keep living a life that's great and there's nothing wrong with it, or you're a maximizer, in which case you're probably going to look at it and you say, okay, there's probably something we can improve in each or at least in some of these areas of life, and let's go for that, right? There's no... most people are going to put answers that are between 6 and 8 just out of personal tendency to these areas of life, yeah. Right? And the infamous coaching question for all situation is like, okay, so where's the delta? What's missing? What needs to happen for it to be a 10?
Yeah,
but absolutely. Now that you've reached it, and I don't know, you're making $1 million a year and you're having fun in your career and you're totally happy in your marriage, you're fit and healthy, and you know, you have a great relationship with God and all your environments are impeccable. So now it's down to, are you happy? Or would you like to achieve more, right? I recently dealt with a health decision about a year ago, right? I had a health decision and my choice was to go on medication or to not go on medication and then figure out another way to handle the situation. I said, I'll figure out another way to handle the situation. And I raised my fitness and health level to the point that it is formally no longer an issue. Right. And in the process, I completed a triathlon event that's called an Ironman. Right. So an Ironman is where you swim, ride your bicycle, and then run. And there's two flavors. There's one that's called half and there's one that's called full.
Yeah.
Well, I completed the half. I think that, you know, good. 7 miles yep. of that thing mm-hmm. is quite enough. It did the tough. Trick. Right. Yeah.
Is this a t-shirt that you're wearing?
It's not this t-shirt, but this is also.
Well, this is another triathlon you did. Okay. Seasoned professional.
This t-shirt reminds me that when I went the first time into this triathlon, for which I got the t-shirt, it was a half of a half of the half. So it was in 1/8 of an Ironman. I needed to swim for 400 meters. And that took me 40 minutes and I nearly drowned in the process.
Okay. Is this in seawater in a pool?
It's in seawater and I had to be assisted out, which of course disqualified me, but I'm not trying to become a champion. I was just trying to complete it.
Yeah.
And I knew that I had to, in the main event, which was long later, I needed to do at least 5 times that distance, right? 2000 meter. And I needed to figure out how to swim properly and all of that. So that's this shirt. It reminds me that there are failures along the path to success. But
it's a process, isn't it? It's a process, like everything else. It's a process. You don't just jump in and go and do a triathlon, you know?
Of course not, right? Otherwise, we'd go into the room and go, everybody take out a piece of paper and write your values.
Yeah, exactly.
And so Lovisa's dying to ask that question again. What's our values?
Yeah. No, that's okay.
So the question now becomes, okay, so I did the half. Is that a 10 or is that not a 10? Do I want to do the full event or not? And the answer for me is not. It's really not, right? I did that to resolve a situation that was impacting my health. I'm healthy. I improved. I resolved that situation. I improved my fitness level. I improved my health. And if I kept it at this level, I'm fine. I don't have to redefine my 11 as the new 10.
Yeah.
But if everything was 10, I'd probably find one of them to say, okay, well, here's what I want to do next.
Yeah. No, absolutely. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. I actually just have one last question because it's really bugging me and it's about biases.
I thought we were looking at the values. Okay.
It's about biases. We can come back to our values, but it's about biases because I think they are very governing in our life and as people. And how do you work with people to distinguish what is their, maybe actually some of their values are based on biases and therefore are they actually valid in that sense? Because they are either affected by the environment that they live in or it's because as our brain works naturally, it kind of connects things like, you know, people coming late. Okay, that person is always late. They're a terrible person. But if I do it, I'm a good person still because I had an excuse. You know, those type of things. How does that affect values? And how do you figure out?
Okay. So the first thing you need to take into consideration is that your non-negotiable values, of although there's like no more than two of them, they behave much different than the other values. The other values are chosen. And what I mean by that is, you must have seen that. You go into an exercise, we're going to figure out, we're going to work on our values today. And here's a sheet with 400 values, literally. Yeah. I have a sheet like that with 400 values to jog your mind and help you choose. And I want you to choose the top six, right? Well, what does it mean? It means that you're against the other 394. So the six that you choose, how do you choose them, right? It's a mental process. You choose them. Sometimes you ask cute questions like, if you were going to a, you know, deserted island and you can only experience these values, but you will not experience the other values, which ones do you choose? That's great. It's still a mental exercise. Your non-negotiable values are an emotional and, to a degree, spiritual exercise. I'm saying spiritual because some people believe that you're born with these values. Some people who are even more spiritual or religious, they would say that your soul was sent to Earth to be embodied so that you can express this value. So they're not chosen. So they're discovered, right? So we have a process whereby you can discover what these two non-negotiable values are. Now, the ones that you choose could be highly impacted by your upbringing and your culture, and you know, and you could go into fierce argument whether punctuality is a value or not, right? I believe it is, like hundreds of other things that are value. And why would it be a value? Why would a value be a value other than if you assign the value to the property, right? And so that could be, you know, people believe in equality and other people don't believe in equality, right? It's a very hot topic these days. But some of the values, and I have not seen a place where a non-negotiable value would become a subject to bias. Right. However, again, let's talk about punctuality. Okay, the person is always late. Well, let's refer back to our code of excellence. So if our code of excellence includes punctuality, which means we're always on time, and the person is always late or considerable amount of time, they're late enough to raise an eyebrow or make people uncomfortable with it, where that's where your team leader's leadership comes into place. That's where your when it becomes a question whether your values in that team include accountability. Well, what accountability looks like. Accountability could look like a rule in the code that says be willing to be called on when you are doing something that's against our values and code of excellence. And oh, by the way, be able to call other people when they do that, because otherwise, you know, people are getting into these unwritten agreements. You know, I'm gonna ignore the fact that you're late, and you're gonna ignore the fact that I do something else that's against the code, and that's breaks the context and just dissipates the energy in the team. And that's if you talk or if you read some of the interviews they did with championship teams, both in the military and in sports and in other fringe locations of life, you'd find that many, many times, in fact, almost all the time, they do it for the team, but what they say about that, they didn't do it, you know, a soccer championship team. Nobody there does it to be the individual king of the world. They do it for the team, right? Even the supporters in the stadium are there for the team. But in the process of putting the team as the goal or the objective or the object for which you're doing what you're doing, there comes a part of calling others on when they're doing something that's against the rules or that's not going to be supportive, and be willing to be called. And that openness of listening and accepting feedback is the corporate version of accountability, right? Be willing to accept feedback, because we all know companies or teams where people aren't willing to accept feedback, they fall apart rather quickly.
Thank you very much. So we've been talking for over about an hour and a half now. I'm happy to continue, Yoram, because this is absolutely very interesting. But I'm just conscious that if you've got, this is the start to your day.
No.
No.
Your day is close to an end. Mine has only started. I have no plans.
No, absolutely. That's what I mean. If you're going to be busy and stuff. I guess, what's the weather like in San Diego? This day, I know we talked last week and it wasn't
miserable.
Is it really?
Yeah, we have
scorching here.
We have a phrase that talks about gray May and gloomy June.
Okay.
And it's weird to me, having grown up elsewhere, but here in San Diego, it's gray and drizzly in June almost every day, whereas in April and March it was sunny and beautiful.
Yeah, but you're on the West Coast, Yoram, aren't you? And are you far from Los Angeles?
What's my measuring question? I'm about what is 70, 80, 100 miles from Los Angeles.
Okay, so not too far then.
If you count it in hours, that could be 5 hours.
Yeah.
Yes, true. Yeah. I've cycled that distance in less time.
Yes.
Not recently. That's for sure. And the reason I was going to ask you this in Los Angeles, have you ever stayed at the Magical Kingdom Hotel?
No, haven't. I've been there, but not stayed there.
Okay. Are you aware of this hotel?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Apparently, it's number 2 on TripAdvisor.
Oh. Wow.
And the reason, it may have changed. This was a few years ago. And I'd gone to a forum the other day there. And you know Dan Heath, the author? Him and his brother Chip. They're both authors. They write various books and stuff like that. And one of the presentations was around this hotel. And when you got to see this hotel, it was terrible. It was horrible looking. But what made it number 2 was it had this sign outside the hotel near the pool saying popsicle stand, call this number. And what happened is, if you called this number, this butler in a black suit with white gloves would bring out a tray of popsicles to the children around the pool. And because of that moment of, you know, children are easily pleased with getting a cold popsicle on a hot sunny day, that was the big thing. I mean, looking at the rooms and looking at the service and looking at everything else was just, you know, downright terrible. But because of that, it's... it raised its profile. So
yeah, it's
amazing. So that was my week, and I really enjoyed that story. But one thing that did come out of this, and I guess this is a new thing, and it might be a new thing just to the States, is that when you're seeking a job, and you have an interview or you go through the interview cycle, then generally there's a bit of a lag between the last interview and you getting an offer. And that's always, you know, there's a moment of cheeriness when that happens type thing. And a new thing that I saw, and you're probably well aware of this, Yoram, and I just wasn't, is that during that final interview, the company or the organization or the people there would have made up their mind already. And so that during the interview, you would actually be offered the job. Now, it wouldn't be a straight offer, there's the contract, sign, you know, welcome to the company. It would be members of the team turning up into the interview to welcome them and give them, you know, the company sweatshirt or, you know, sports cap or whatever, you know, but welcome them. So just to experience that joy of welcoming them to the organization. And I thought that was a really nice thing. Now, we're in a forum and there's like about, I don't know, 500 people in this forum. And so he shows this video and this young lady who wants to be a school teacher, and she was asked during the interview cycles, why did you want to be a teacher? And she shared the story that of her first teacher who really inspired her, really told her to go for it type thing. She actually, on that final interview stage, she turns up to offer the job. And it's such, it was such a real moment. And the topic comes under the power of moments. And it's those single instances where it's not what you saw or what you heard or what you did, it's how you felt when it happened. And it's so uplifting and so memorable that it's, that's, if you had to do a TripAdvisor or whatever survey tool you had to do for each of moments in your life, that would be the memory. And I don't mind sharing this, but with 500 people, everyone was in tears, myself included. And the lady next to me, she was completely gone, you know, and it was just a fantastic expression. And you know, I don't know if it's going to be commonplace, but I thought that's the type of thing, as we keep talking about being human and expressing ourselves in a human way, because as I opened up the conversation earlier, was as me and myself and Lovisa, when we used to go to clients, we had to be the smartest person as the way that we walk through the door. And we're never really given the opportunity to be not the smartest, or, you know, you had to be the expert the minute you arrived. And so you didn't really give yourself that opportunity to say, oh, that's an interesting question, let me take that away, you know, and I'll come back to you. Now we, you know, as experienced consultants, we now recognize we do have that capability of doing that. Mm. But in the junior or the early years of your career, you don't feel like you have that, and they feel like you almost have to be responsive immediately. You don't create that space for yourself. Someone's asked you a question and then you respond. But then you, as you alluded to, you make, by responding quickly, you make the wrong decision, because you make the wrong decision because you've listened with the purpose of replying, not with the purpose of understanding. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that doesn't work well in relationships, does it?
No.
And I guess it doesn't work well in any human interaction, really, does
right.
it?
Right. No. And I think that we're done being the smartest people in the room. And I think we're done for good with it, because with the advances that you have with AI right now, nobody in the room is going to be as smart as your phone that's on that's sitting on the desk or your laptop. And it's no longer, I feel we're going to experience a shift from the relative weight of expertise of the people in the room to a place where the people in the room, their function is going to make the decision of what to do about the information or what to do with the information rather than getting at it because we're going to have it.
Yeah, exactly. And also the human part of it. So luckily, we haven't been able to program AI yet to be able to care and nurture and, you know, develop. I hate to say the soft part, but if you understand what I mean of people rather than the hard skills, that's the beautiful part of it too.
And that allays the fears, isn't it? Because people hear AI and they automatically think that a robot can now do their job. But and that's not true because, you know, if you're in a job that's very robotic and requires very little concentration or thought process of how to deliver it, then fine, yes, a machine could easily take that job. But everyone knows that your day-to-day job relies on some sort of human interaction where it relies on the thoughts and the feelings and the emotions of how to create that transaction. And so I don't think that AI, and I know it's a big thing just now, and I know it becomes another enabler to help, you know, speed up things. And one of the examples that they gave at the forum I was at the other day there, because it was called Work Human, was if you think of this, if you had to write some feedback for someone in the organization, your peer or you know, subordinate, etc., and you had to write something, you're starting with a blank sheet of paper. You know, you're starting with a flashing cursor that says start free texting. And what AI does is it just speeds up that because it creates some random generative text around a subject matter. You type in the subject saying, you know, feedback review. Oh, okay, feedback review for a peer. You know, and then it asks you, do you want it to be serious? Do you want it to be professional? Do you want it to be quirky or funny or whatever? And then it starts to emulate that. Now, the job's not done. You wouldn't send that out back to your respondent and say, oh, there's my feedback, because they would spot a mile away. It was AI generated. And so therefore, you have to then, they've taken away some of the labor or that allowed you to get that start, but then you still have to go in and tailor it and you humanize it, you know. Mm-hmm. And I thought that was a great example of allaying fears that, you know, not everybody's job is at risk just because of the latest, I guess, technological advance.
I think, you know, some jobs are going to disappear and some jobs are going to be helped tremendously by AI, but I don't see that as the end of the world.
No.
Sure, if you allow AI to make military decision and to, you know, send nuclear weapons to another country, that's not a good idea. But we have the breadth and depth of history to recognize that we don't have typists anymore, and we don't have phone operators anymore. And there's, as technology progresses, people are being relieved of doing some tasks and they get to do other stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah,
totally true.
In fact, I heard this example that somebody brought up, and they said when they started YouTube, they were in fear that this is the end of creativity, and look what happened. The number of people who were able to express themselves creatively has gone up exponentially.
Yep.
So
exactly.
Indeed.
I am and, super sorry. I have to leave soon. I've been up since 4 o'clock this morning, so my fumes are starting to burn out a little bit. I'm and really apologies. Sorry about that.
Apologies, Lovisa. I was going to, I did mean to ask you whether you were okay to continue, because we have been talking for quite a bit of time. But fascinating, absolutely fascinating. I guess then, so let's, so I have one thing I just want to touch on that you mentioned last week, Yoram, when we had the sort of pre-session connect. This, and I can't remember exactly the expression that you used, but it was the, I guess you were 21 and, you know, you were, I guess, cocksure of yourself. And you had, what did you, you called it some kind of, it wasn't quite arrogance, but it was something. And I wish I'd remembered what you said.
I sure don't.
And it really was that way of saying, you know what? I am the smartest person in the room, but it's justified. Because I've put in the effort and the work and the, you know, the skills necessary to say, you know what, I'm not trying to be boastful or arrogant, but I'm telling, if I tell you that I can do something, you bloody better believe that I can do it.
Right.
And so, and the, you know, and it's the exuberance of youth, isn't it, to an extent? And as, you know, I think we can all see that some people will not do that. They'll be, you know, useful with them talking the talk, but not able to walk the walk, shall we say. And that's always a disappointment when that comes to an end, really, isn't it? But you seem so cocksure of yourself at that time that, you know, nothing was going to stop you. And I guess, you know, I don't know how many years have passed since that time, Yoram, and I'm really not going to ask you. But do you still feel that you're so sure of your own capability without being cocky or arrogant that you're constantly going to provide value to yourself and to others?
It's an excellent question, right? When you talk to a teenager or somebody in their early 20s, then you know how it is. You know, nothing's going to stop them and they're never going to die. but the part about being the smartest person in the room, as long as we have ranks and measurements, somebody's end up going to have the highest grade in the room. Right? So I took recently a cognitive aptitude test, came up. I have a rather high mark, right? I'm somewhere in the top 0.8%. That's extremely high, blah, blah, blah. I don't consider myself to be all that smart, actually. I consider myself being smart at solving these types of questions, right? And I think you're referring to the part where I said that I was off the chart with the IQ, but EQ, the chart wasn't invented yet. So,
yes.
And had it been invented, I wouldn't know how to get on it at that point in my life. So I think the part of not wanting to be the smartest person in the room is the part about challenging yourself, about putting yourself in a situation where you can learn something from other people. And oh, by the way, you can learn something from everybody. So is not how I consider myself, is where I want to find myself. I want to find myself in a situation where I can learn from people. Now, the difference is when you're 20, you're looking more for these quote unquote objective, because I don't think they are, but quote unquote objective measures of who are the people you can learn from. As time goes by, and as I worked on my openness to listen and to learn, then I can learn from pretty much everybody. Can I add value? I think I can. And if I can't add value, then I'd probably want to go elsewhere where I can add value. So that's the second part of it. And there is a lot of not a lot, but I read at least a couple of articles about a phenomenon called reverse mentoring.
Okay. Yeah.
And reverse mentoring is when you take somebody who's in their 50s or 60s in an organization and assign a 30 or 20 years old mentor to them who would mentor them on specific areas, right? Yeah. Technology is a great example because there are a lot of people up there in age where technology is not part of their upbringing.
Yeah.
So the more people are open to who they can learn from, the easier and the richer time they have in their life. They may still be, according to one measure or another, the smartest person in the room, but I don't think it means as much as I thought it meant when I was 20. Okay.
No, but absolutely. I mean, when you're sort of young and full of beans, and you know, as you say there, don't think you're ever going to die type thing. You know, everything's a possibility. You know, and that's always a great thing. And you don't really want to quash that. And I guess you know, what they've got four generations of the population in the workplace now. You know, baby boomers, Generation X, millennials.
I believe it's five. Yeah.
Oh, is it five? Oh, fantastic.
As long as the baby boomers are still there, there's the millennials and then X, Y, and Z, and Alpha is coming on board.
Yes. Yeah. No, absolutely. Yeah. And so what you get there is I guess different opportunities, different perspectives. Don't get me wrong, as we talked about biases there earlier, is that, you know, maybe the baby boomers and Generation X are firmly holding on to the bias that youth isn't always the smartest, but you know, maybe that's maybe an eroding perception, shall we say. Absolutely, we could learn from everyone, aren't we? And never again comes back to that point of, you know, that whatever that trigger is, use the space to understand, you know, where that person's coming from and understanding their perspective. And it's such a valuable thing, isn't it? So,
yeah, 100%. And perspective is the key word, right? Because perspective taking, that's the key in conflict resolution, but that's also the key in learning. Because the moment you sidestep whatever is, and even when you don't sidestep whatever is the exact sciences, quote unquote, in a big way, right? Because of what, for example, Einstein did to Newton, then you start seeing that you need to see things from a different angle in order to understand it many, many times.
Absolutely. Yeah, indeed.
Yeah.
Brilliant. So on that point, because I'm going to take Lovisa's point that she's now running on fumes, and I'm not surprised from 4 o'clock this morning. I've done that shift before, and it's hard and tiring. Yoram, it's been an absolute pleasure to speak to you today and to share your life story and your values. And it'd be really nice if we could continue on another podcast episode where we have that opportunity, myself and Lovisa, to share our values and go through and almost reverse that situation where you can draw out of us what, you know, what was the root, why you came to that conclusion, why do you think they're valuable, etc. And ask a few awkward questions yourself. That would be really great.
Sure.
So if you don't mind, I'll stop recording, I'll wrap up things for the time being, but Yoram, once again, absolute pleasure. Lovisa, you know, this is always great when we're together. But I'll, Yoram, a last point from yourself before we close the call?
No, I don't think so. I would say, hey, if, you know, if things don't, you know, bring you joy, don't do them. Yeah. Which is another way to say that I totally underscore the fact that the only life worth living is a value-based life. And I hope more people get to do that.
Fantastic. Perfect. I can't add anything more to that, Yoram. Lovisa?
No, I think that was a perfect ending.
Absolutely. And that's where it will stop.